Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, February 4th. The American story is also resoundingly the story of the South. So much of the making of this country took place below the Mason-Dixon line, where our nation's capital, don't forget, the symbol of which was built on the backs of enslaved people, remains. So now we'll talk about the South's message to America and what we can learn about the country's history from a closer look at the experiences of Black Americans who called the South home. Joining us in just a minute will be Imani Perry, professor of African American Studies at Princeton. Her new book is called South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon Line to Understand the Soul of a Nation, Its History, and Its Contemporary Realities. And again, Professor Imani Perry from Princeton has her new book called South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon Line to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Professor Perry, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC today.
Thank you for having me.
And you included a disclaimer that said, please remember, while this book is not a history, it's a true story. How do you distinguish between a true story from and a history for the purposes of this work?
Sure. Yeah. So history is, you know, it's a form, right? It has a very particular method that's disciplinary, that is goes and tells a kind of coherent storyline. A story, I think, in this respect, is much more a kind of invitation to walk with me. I'm asking readers to be present with me in these places, to understand them as places that have layered meanings, that are ambiguous, that are complicated. And I'm not telling readers what to think or even making a particular argument, but rather it's a, you know, it's an invitation. It's an expose of sorts. It's wanting to encourage a discussion about the centrality of this place in our history and in our culture.
And some of this, I see, is personal for you. Do you want to tell the listeners anything about your
Sure.
own family roots in the South and how it relates to the bigger picture?
Yes. I mean, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. I locate myself 9 years after the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, 3 miles away is where I was born. Most of my family has always lived in the South and continues to. I migrated north as a small child, but went back and forth my entire life. And I also traveled to other parts of the South regularly in addition to preparation for this book. So it is home, but a home in which I describe myself in some sense as an exile from. And so I have seen it both from the inside and been very aware of the way people in other regions, especially in the Northeast, see the South. And so it's that insider outsider perspective that I bring to bear on the book.
And you open with a story of a man named Shields Green, who was known as the Emperor of New York. So who was Shields
yes.
Green, and why did you start a book about South with him?
Well, I started the book in West Virginia, and particularly in Harper's Ferry, and he was a member of John Brown's, group that sought to overthrow the Confederacy. I mean, not the Confederacy, emancipate Black people from slavery and initiate what would be a civil war, and they failed ultimately, but it was an important, John Brown's raid was an important event as a precursor to the Civil War. And I wanted to talk about someone like him because, you know, West Virginia is this interesting place that was seceded from Virginia because, in the context of the Civil War, ultimately, because it was anti-slavery and then becomes associated with a kind of neo-Confederacy later. And here we have this figure who is from South Carolina, but is referred to as the Emperor of New York and as a member of John Brown's raid and didn't leave records because he was not literate, but is sort of this story figure in history. And I just wanted people to begin in a place of the ambiguity about the story of the country, right? Where it begins, what regions were pro and anti-slavery, because I wanted a kind of disorientation in a sense. I want people to encounter it in a fresh way because we operate with all of these stereotypes, particularly at the South, but of all the regions. And so it was meaningful to me to put us in places and with people who we don't ordinarily think about.
Let's take a phone call and hear a story from Sharon in Harlem. Sharon, you're on WNYC with Princeton's Imani Perry. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests, and good morning, Brian, second time caller. Yes, my connection is very closely to the South. My father grew up in a segregated Alabama, Mobile, Alabama, Greenville. And there were his grandfather, he wanted to be like his grandfather who had 11 children. So he had 11 children. I'm number 10. And my father often talked about the experiences growing up in a segregated South. He tells of a particular experience where he was a child and the Ku Klux Klan were marching through the streets, through the town. And he, as a child, being curious, he leaned over to get a better peek, but his foot slipped off the curb and he fell into the path of the protest of folks marching, and the white man slapped him. And that was his experience that he never forgot. And one of the things he vowed that he wanted a better life for himself, that he could not live in this segregated South. But he had family and aunties and all that. So he'd go back and forth. He said he'd let some of my brothers and sisters go down to visit. I never got the chance to, unfortunately. But I know the stories. I have a picture, a tintype of my grandmother, who she... I could see all the way we're related, but even just the whole thing about family, that deep connection. And so that is what we took from the South. That is what we carry even now with my own children, my own grandchildren. And we can tell the stories of our grandparents and tell the story of his grandmother. He was a freeborn slave. His father was a freeborn slave. And I didn't understand. I saw it in books. But that 13, 14, and 15 child were freeborn slaves. Mm. And my father always says, I'm a child of a freeborn slave. So that's my connection to the South. Thank you so much for letting me share that story.
Thank you. And please call a third time, Sharon. Wow, freeborn slave is probably a term that a lot of people have never heard.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's something that the caller said that is so resonant, which is that the significance of family, which is in part, in particularly for Black Southerners, because of how vulnerable the structure of family was historically, right? So that if you did not actually, you could not claim possession of your children and you weren't sure whether or not your children would be sold away or treated violently or the like, that there is a culture that holds very tightly to family. I also think this point is interesting, which is about what it means for what the South means for migrants, because so often for the South, for people who are from great migration families, the South that they think about is that one from multiple generations ago. But for people like me, and really the majority of African Americans who still live in the South, there's never been a moment in history of this country where the majority of Black people were anywhere but the South. And so there's this sort of past vantage point, and then there's the present South. And there's also the truth that many migrants who left the South, either for work or as a result of violence, encountered incredibly violent northern cities, particularly in the Midwest. Oftentimes, Southerners call the North everything that's not the South, but for all the different regions. But there's a lot of racial violence. And I think, you know, that's the other thing, too, that's really important to keep in mind.
Let's take another call. Sam in Kew Gardens in Queens. You're on WNYC with Monty Perry from Princeton. Hi, Sam.
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, that's you.
Hi.
good morning, Sam. This is my second time calling, Brian. The first time I called was when you had the emergency room doctor offering an explanation as to why African Americans avoided the COVID vaccine because of our suspicions of doctors. And I had 30 seconds at the end of the show.
Well, I'm glad you're getting a second shot. You can have more than 30 seconds today.
Well, I mentioned to the screener that it wasn't really clear to me what you're looking for, except that I grew up in South Carolina. I have lived a year in West Virginia and 10 or more years in Alabama before coming to the Northeast for grad school. And so I've been in New York City since May of 93. but I still have ties to the South, still go there as often as I can. And I mentioned to the caller that I could tell a story about having a white lady come to my rescue when I fell off a bike as a child, if that was of any interest or whatever.
Mm. Well, you mentioned to my screener, if I got the screener's message right, that you've gotten into many arguments with people who presume to know the South without ever being there. What's an example of such an argument, if I have that right?
Well, it wasn't many, but it was a couple of doozies. One was in San Francisco and one was here in New York. Basically, I've had people who freely admit to never having been to the South, or except for maybe Florida, or having spent any significant time there, who nevertheless will argue with me, a black person who grew up in the South, about what it was like to be a black person in the South. These were neither black people, nor had they been to the South, yet they presumed to argue with me about what it was like to be a black person in the South without apparently realizing how insulting it is that they think that they know better what my experience is than I do.
And what was it about your experience, or one thing about your experience in the South, that you think people didn't hear easily?
Well, they think that there are strong prejudices about the South, about what it's like for black people in the South. And one thing that I would say to people is that, in my experience, and in the experience of my family, class was maybe more of an important thing than race, and that we were, I guess, near the bottom of the middle class. I'd never considered us poor, but if we were middle class, we were lower middle class. Both my parents worked outside of the home in factory jobs. We had enough money to get by. They had enough money to build and buy a new house and all of that. So we never wanted for anything. So as a child, I never considered us as anywhere approaching being needy, although I did know people who were needy, you know.
Sam, I'm gonna leave it there and get some thoughts from Professor Perry. Thank you, and please call us again. Some interesting things.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a great set of things that Sam just said. One, absolutely, there are all of these stereotypes where people presume to know the South. And this is part of why I quote a man in Appalachia saying, you know, it's important to be humble, right? The sort of the don't act as though you know everything. He mentioned being helped by a white woman when he fell off his bike as a kid. There's so much intimacy across racial lines in the South that it's relatively rare in northern cities that I think people often miss, right? There is both intimacy and racism simultaneously. There's closeness. People live in much less segregated communities.
Jimmy Carter has talked about that.
Yes. Oh, no, it's absolutely true. And I think also the really important point about the significance of class and not just the sort of racial logics. And similarly, you know, we came north for my mother to go to graduate school. And so that is a distinct perspective, in part because I think people think that black people were all trying to escape the South. And that's just not true. I mean, there's people often traveled for work or for opportunity, but still feel as though that is home and actually have either preference or deep emotional ties for the South. And I think that's an important corrective, because the projection of racism on the South allows for other regions of the country to feel as though they are absolved of the inequality that exists everywhere.
And bringing this even more toward the present, it's been 50 years already, I think it would be accurate to say, since after the Great Migration of black people from the South to the North in the United States. There's been a kind of reverse Great Migration, or reverse some level of migration, that's seen many black Americans leave the North for Southern cities and Southern suburbs.
Absolutely. And I think part of that is because lower cost of living, a perception that there's a higher quality of life in Southern cities, that it's a sort of easier pace of living. And it's also important to note that as an addition to the Great Migration story, the Great Migration story is also a story about the Great Migration of white Southerners who were also seeking labor opportunities. And mm-hmm. as people have found themselves precariously situated, you know, it's always the case that people move when they are looking for more stable living. And so, you know, this is the history of the movement, I think, is the history of the country writ large. And notably, more white Southerners proportionately migrated in the Great Migration than black Southerners did.
Do you think that the South, and I guess by that I mean the white South, has dealt more directly and more effectively with racism than maybe the white North, because the white North, while having lots of racism in it, comforted itself with, you know, the fact that Jim Crow didn't officially exist here and slavery didn't officially exist here.
Right. Well, did, but was abolished earlier.
Right.
You know, and I think, so, and not legal Jim Crow, but certainly enforced segregation, right? And
exactly.
practice in so many places.
That's the
and
distinction.
So yes, right. You know, I don't know. I don't think it's fair to make a sort of overarching assessment. I will say that the larger social and civic and legal impact of the civil rights movement is very apparent. So, for example, schools in southern cities are much less segregated than in New York, right? And rates of high school graduation are greater in for black people in southern cities than they are in New York, for example. And I do think that, you know, and at the same time, there is a kind of distancing from those legacies in the sense of what is the accountability that is required, right? But I would want to go back to something you said earlier about the political landscape, because the confusion that's created by the red state, blue state map thing, and you mentioned, you know, the mention of Staten Island, right? Mm-hmm. There's this perception that, you know, certain places are Democrat and certain places are Republican and relatively conservative. And while there's, you know, the whole country is purple and there are so many blue counties in the South and cities
right.
and towns.
Right.
And I think, and so we, one of the ways that we don't deal with the complexity of our political landscape is we focus on the color of the states on the map as opposed to the landscape, right? And who votes in which way and why and how are they moved about politically. So the South has this cultural power because of Southern elite politicians, but their message resonates far beyond the region. And that is important to attend to.
Imani Perry, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Her new book is South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon Line to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Great conversation. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.